This Hour's top stories. The Yemeni army says it has launched a major drone and ballistic missile attack on Aramco facilities and military bases in Saudi Arabia. China sanctions a group of British lawmakers and organizations over what it calls lies and disinformation about its treatment of minorities. Also ahead, the UN warns of an alarming crisis in Ethiopia's conflict-hit Tigray region amid a rise in the number of targeted killings and rape cases. Our top story this hour, the Yemeni army says it has launched a major drone and ballistic missile attack on Saudi Arabia.
Snow-Day resilience operation targeted vital Saudi military headquarters and installations. It was carried out with 18 drones and 8 ballistic missiles. Aramco oil facilities in Ras Hanura, Rabigh, Jizan, Yanbu, and King Abdulaziz base in Dammam were targeted. Armed forces also targeted military sites in Najran and Asir with Class F-2K drones. National-Day resilience operation successfully achieved its goals. We warned the Saudi-led aggression of consequences of continuing its attacks and blockade of Yemen. We affirm our readiness to carry out more military operations in the future.
Saudi Defense Ministry has confirmed the Yemeni attack on an oil products distribution station in Jizan. The ministry said it will take action to protect its oil exports. Latest attacks by the Yemeni army come on the 6th anniversary of the Saudi invasion of the country. The Yemeni army, backed by Ansarullah forces, has conducted similar attacks in the past. They say they are in retaliation for Riyadh's war that has so far claimed tens of thousands of lives in Yemen. Abdul Latif al-Washali in Sana'a told me earlier the latest Yemeni attacks on Saudi Arabia are the largest operation against the kingdom since the beginning of the war.
The Yemeni army inaugurates the 7th year of war against the Yemeni people with the largest and the biggest operation so far, using 18 drones and 8 ballistic missiles targeting several facilities, economic facilities and military bases in Ras Tanura, Rabigh, Yanbu', Jizan, Dammam, Asir. The Yemeni army keeps intensifying its operations and retaliatory attacks against Saudi Arabia. Aramco is now the main target for the Yemeni army as it seeks to harm the Saudi economy. Yemenis today are entering the 7th year of war. They will be protesting in Sana'a and several governorates. Tens of thousands will be out on the streets to voice their voices to the world that they are coming to the 7th year with being stronger and being able to attack Saudi Arabia, being able to pressure Saudi Arabia to make it seek for peace and to stop its war against Yemenis.
To discuss the same issue, Mr. Tim Anderson is joining us. He is the director with the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies via Skype out of Sydney. Tim Anderson, it's good to have you with us. Tell me how you react to this latest attack, which, mind you, our correspondent just said was the largest in its kind since the beginning of the war.
Thank you. Yes, the Yemeni army is certainly pressing its advantage, given that the Saudis are on the retreat. And the so-called peace offering offered up and supported by the U.S., it was obviously a transparent attempt to try and avoid that sort of retreat. But Yemen is still occupied in many respects. There's still a battle for the liberation of Marib, and I'm sure that Yemeni forces are going to try and press their advantage to secure a ceasefire on much more advantageous terms.
Okay, Mr. Anderson, let's just go back to the beginning of the war. You know, incidentally, today, I believe, is the anniversary of this war, 6th anniversary of the war. How would you comment on that? Do you say that Saudi Arabia has met the defined goals that it basically defined for itself, you know, the goals of this war, and perhaps any achievement that the Saudis have had, those goals have been met? How do you react to that?
Well, first of all, I would say that the Saudis are clearly acting as the agent of the U.S. here. Let's not be under any illusion that they are some independent force there. They are a tiny puppet regime, basically, that has a lot of oil money. It was able to buy a lot of weapons, but they are serving the interests of Washington in its plan for a new Middle East to wipe out all of the independent political will the political states in the region, basically, and the Ansar Allah-led government in Sana'a is one of the things that was very inconvenient to them. And, of course, Israel is also involved in this operation along with the Emiratis. So the Saudis, as the spearhead of that, if you like, have not achieved any of their objectives. They've been on retreat for some time now, and as your report points out, that's the Yemenis are pressing their advantage now that they have the upper hand.
You mentioned the Saudis being actually the hand of some larger powers and perhaps, you know, change the equilibrium in the West Asia region, if I understood correctly. Those larger powers, you compare this to 2015. And, you know, it's very interesting, Mr. Anderson, isn't it, that like 6 years ago, even people in news media, they hadn't heard the name Ansarullah. And right now, they're a force to reckon with. How has this really changed that equilibrium in the favor of those larger powers when you compare the West Asia region to what it was back in 2015?
Yes, I think you're right to point out that 2015 was a turning point, because at that stage, the two big counterweights, Iran and Russia, made some more concerted efforts, for example, in Syria, and helped turn the tide there too. But when we talk about Yemen, let's remember it's not simply Ansar Allah. Ansar Allah created a very large coalition. Most of the Yemeni army defected to this coalition government, and it's had very strong popular support. So we shouldn't be under no illusions, even though the Western governments continue to maintain that a man under in-house detention in Riyadh is the president of Yemen. We should be under no illusion. There is quite a strong government with a strong public backing there, and despite the siege, they've demonstrated that they're able to resist and they're able to press their advantage.
And, you know, again, because it's the sixth anniversary, I'd like to seize this opportunity to ask you, what kind of a prediction do you have for the days to come? Perhaps, you know, not only because of this recent attack, you know, which will obviously bring about some, you know, tit-for-tat move from the Saudi side, but basically where to go from now? You just said that the Saudis are basically going back and, you know, are looking for ways to drag themselves out of this quagmire of a war. In what direction do you think 2021 version of the Yemen war will be unfolding?
Well, first of all, yes, it's correct to say that the Saudis have been looking for a way out for almost 3 years, really. Remember, they started some talks in Oman. They tried to find some way out without abandoning their project altogether, because from the point of view of the regional war, which Washington is orchestrating and which it announced in Israel in 2006, the idea of creating a new Middle East led by Israel and the Saudis, that is evaporating very badly. But of course, they're not able to accept defeat. They know that they're losing in Syria, they're losing in Iraq, they're losing in Yemen, but they don't like to accept that. So they're extending this. And I think we shouldn't underestimate the capacity of extending this losing gambit that the U.S. is involved in. And let's remember that the U.S. is always behind the Saudi hand here.
Again, before I let you go, because you just mentioned the very interesting point, let's not forget that President Biden has just said that they won't be able to meet the deadline that they had for bringing out their forces on May the 1st. And, you know, that was a deal that they had with the Taliban. Interestingly, that they were the force, together with Al-Qaeda, actually, back in 2001. They were the force that were fighting. And now, after 20 years, they just sat down with them at the table and wrote an agreement. And when you look at Afghanistan today, there is still internal fighting. There can still be violence for the presence of the U.S. forces there. You know, I wonder if we are to, I don't know if we can actually generalize that strategy to what happens in Yemen as well. Okay, if you say that Saudi Arabia is going to extend its war there and, you know, perhaps come down hard with vengeance for each and every one of these attacks, are we going to see the repeat of this drag of a war that happened in Afghanistan, perhaps in this region, in this part of the world as well?
Look, from the part of the Saudis, it may not be that they have the capacity to be able to press it. They're losing very badly on a number of fronts. But from the point of view of Washington, it's quite possible that they're going to develop some idea of a retreat, let's say, from Syria and Iraq. and handing over to subcontract their conflicts and their destabilization, because remember, their second option, if they can't have the regimes they want in the region, they will try and destabilize them, divide them, and keep them weak as long as possible. So it's, of course, that's not necessarily going to work out very well for the Saudis. They have their own problems there, and they may not be able to respond easily.
Tim Anderson, Director for Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies in Sydney, I really appreciate it. The United Nations Special Rapporteur says a top Saudi official has issued a death threat against her for investigating the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. She published a 100-page report in June of 2019, concluding that there was credible evidence that the Saudi Crown Prince and other officials were liable for that killing. Khashoggi was killed and dismembered, if you remember, inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October of 2018.
Back in 2018, Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist and critic of the Saudi government, was murdered after he entered Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Saudi Arabia initially denied any knowledge of Khashoggi's fate, as the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, told Bloomberg News that the journalist left the consulate shortly after he entered and that there is nothing to hide. However, recordings and other evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed how a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. In February, a long-awaited U.S. intelligence report also concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved and probably ordered the assassination of Khashoggi. But Washington stopped short of targeting bin Salman with financial or other sanctions. A report released in June 2019 by the U.N. Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard concluded that there was credible evidence that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and other senior officials were behind Khashoggi's assassination and called the murder an international crime. Lately, Calamard has revealed she was threatened by the Saudis for her role in the Khashoggi investigation. She said a colleague alerted her that a Saudi official had threatened to have her taken care of. The UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary, and Arbitrary Killings says the officials in the room had considered the remarks as a death threat. Calamard, who will this month take on her new post as the Secretary General of Amnesty International, had previously slammed the international community for their failure to ensure justice in Khashoggi's assassination.
Effectively, we see the United Nations is powerless because it is in the hand of the superpower, and particularly the United States, that has the veto decision on anything that goes against its own interest.
While a U.S. intelligence report in February revealed that Mohammed bin Salman directly approved the killing of Jamal Khashoggi in October of 2018, the U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has failed to directly penalize the Saudi Crown Prince. Biden has rejected the idea of punishing bin Salman for Washington and Riyadh have an alliance. That is while Riyadh is the largest arms importer in the world during the past 5 years. Let me check, 24% of the U.S. arms exports went to Saudi Arabia.
A declassified U.S. intelligence report revealed that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, had ordered the gruesome killing of Saudi opposition journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Biden administration only announced sanctions recently and visa bans on the citizens involved in Khashoggi's murder, but stopped short of imposing sanctions on the Crown Prince himself. That is while the U.S. President Joe Biden rejected the idea of holding bin Salman accountable for the murder. He stated that Washington has an alliance with Riyadh and cannot punish its head of state. Indeed, Washington's alliance with Riyadh is a lucrative one. The U.S. has accounted for 37% of global arms exports in the world between 2016 and 2020, making it the largest arms exporter in the last 5 years. A major chunk of that goes to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the biggest arms importer in the world and alone accounted for 24% of total U.S. arms exports during the same period. Weapons, which have been used in Yemen war to kill thousands of innocent children and civilians and cause the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States is protecting Saudi Arabia, violation of human rights and all genocidal crime that Saudi Arabia is doing, not only against the dissident, but also in Yemen.
The U.S. President Joe Biden has refused to penalize the Saudi Crown Prince, despite the fact that he promised to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state for Khashoggi's killing and other abuses during his 2020 presidential campaign. While the U.S. benefits from its lucrative alliance with the Saudis, it seems that the green dollars have lured Washington to turn a blind eye to Riyadh's crimes.
To another one of our headlines this hour, China has imposed sanctions on more than a dozen British companies and individuals for what it calls spreading lies about the situation of its Muslim Uyghur minority. Five British lawmakers, including former Conservative Party leader Ian Duncan Smith, are among those sanctioned. All of the sanctioned parties will be barred from Chinese territory, while their property will be frozen there. Also, Chinese citizens and institutions will be banned from doing business with them. China says the measures are in response to UK sanctions over alleged human rights abuses against Uyghurs.
The UK imposed unilateral sanctions on relevant Chinese individuals and entity, citing the so-called human rights issues in Xinjiang. This move, based on nothing but lies and disinformation, flagrantly breaches international law and basic norms governing international relations, grossly interferes in China's internal affairs, and severely undermines China-UK relations.
China said it is firmly determined to safeguard its national sovereignty and security, but warned of further measures if Britain goes further down the wrong path. The U.S. and the EU, as well as Canada, have also imposed sanctions on China over alleged human rights violations against Uyghurs in Xinjiang. China has rejected the allegations, saying its camps in the region offer vocational training. The UN's Deputy Humanitarian Coordinator for Ethiopia has warned of, quote-unquote, an alarming crisis in the conflicted Tigray region. In a virtual briefing to the UN, Wafa Said pointed to targeted civilian killings and hundreds of recent rape cases. Said said an increasing number of people are fleeing violence, while more than 4 million need food. A UN official said children are on the brink of starvation in Tigray. Northern Ethiopian region has witnessed fighting between Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's forces and regional leaders since November of 2020. A fighting has killed thousands of people and displaced hundreds of thousands. Earlier this month, UN leaders called for an investigation into possible war crimes and crimes against humanity in Tigray. Okay, that seems to be it for me.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Iran Today.
Buy a brick and lay the foundation for a school. That's a scheme being promoted in Iran to promote charity school building. It's a resolution significant enough for charities, donors, and officials to aim for New Year to complete projects. Projects consist of constructing, renovating, or refitting schools. Volunteer and charity work is a world popular. But imagine channeling any amount of resources towards school building. It's a big project doable with the accumulation of lots of small sums and efforts. In Iran, school building and donating to society is a tradition. Could do with a little backup from the law. For a word with all walks involved, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. The current Iranian calendar year, beginning March the 21st, saw a total budget of 48 trillion rials earmarked for school renovation nationwide. That's over $1 billion at the official exchange rate of 42,000 rials to the dollar, signifying a 65% increase year on year. The $1.1 billion budget is a difficult sum to muster up, but not much to spend with the rial devalued so badly. And so the Organization for Renovation, Development and Equipment of Schools of Iran cannot work alone. I got to talk to some private donors. Mr. Siavash doesn't even live in Iran, and he's in the retail business, but still, he cares to donate schools to Iran.
The fifth school I built myself has this problem. The roof of the school was collapsing, making it impossible for the students to study, so it was closed. I tried hard to find a volunteer, but no one cooperated. I don't want to break down the reason for it, but my hands are tied over such a matter. But I was determined to do that. I witnessed many things in the school because it was partly open and kids were coming in to study. The building was derelict and the roof was about to collapse any second. That was why I made the decision, and finally, the renovation organization cooperated with me, and thank God, we finished the school a few days ago.
An impressive donor I have to introduce to you is Mr. Baniadam. Let's hear him out.
Our educational spaces would be totally destroyed if it weren't for members of the charity. We would have had schools working in four shifts. Back at the beginning of the Islamic Revolution, there were schools that worked at three shifts. We had such schools in the southern parts of Tehran that changed shifts every other week. But thank to God, charity members came to our help and built 30% to 35% of the schools.
Iran has 450 school building charities and 650,000 donors inside the country and 1,000 donors outside. It's benefactors that have constructed 30% of the country's schools. Mr. Ghorbani is the connecting thread between all my donors. Let's hear him.
We currently have about 30,000 charity school building members identified in the country. They are registered, about 20,000 of whom are male benefactors and 5,000 others female. There are also about 5,000 companies and legal entities that are active in the field of school construction. Up to 30% of our country's schools are built with the participation of donors. Very few countries in the world have this share of benefactors' participation in the construction and development of educational spaces.
President Hassan Rouhani himself officially inaugurated some 1,550 educational training and welfare projects across the country in November 2020 via video conferencing.
Basically, governments are tasked with policy making. Governments are concerned with where we should build schools and where the population needs schools. If you build schools somewhere that doesn't have enough students, it shows the policy has been wrong. The School Building Charity Association, as a grassroots organization, happens to play this very role. In other words, in addition to paying attention to the location of schools, we take into account how the schools are constructed. We make sure the intention of the benefactors is being observed, and we also ensure that the land use does not change afterwards. We're basically standing beside the benefactors and monitoring what the government does.
The projects included 1,422 educational places with 8,051 classrooms, 124 training centers, and 4 welfare centers, measuring a total of 1.1 million square meters. But why this urge to build schools when a strained economy makes more soup houses sound like the best idea of social service?
Unfortunately, the prisons are filled with people who lack education. By building one school, we can close down at least one prison. That's how I look at it. I may be wrong, but taking action, building schools is much better than doing nothing and putting the building off for months. We need to build it as long as we have the opportunity. Time flies. We can't sit idly for months. If we have reached a decision, we need to enact it. If we haven't decided what course of action to take, we need to make that decision fast.
The importance of schooling means zooming in on the remotest parts of a vast country of green plains, harsh mountains, and dry deserts. There are over 1.5 million nomads in Iran today, divided by name but united by blood and nationality. Tribes such as the Bakhtiaris, Bactrians or Lurs basically, and Kurds. There are currently 210,000 nomadic students studying in 14,000 classrooms across the country, and their numbers increased by 10% in a year beginning March 2019. Mr. Baniyadam tells of his passion for school building and how he paired up with someone of his faith to act on his passion. Their latest project, he mentioned, was work on Tehran's District 22, which began 7-8 months ago. Land prices have gone through the roof, but it is the Ministry of Education that tends to provide the land for school building projects.
The first school I built was located somewhere called Alart, which was a village in the vicinity of Robat Karim. I was so happy with what I had done that I immediately started making the second, third, and fourth. I sold my lands and built schools. In about 20 years, the charity community built 30-35% of the schools in the entire country. Over the past 6-7 months, we have planned a biennial program. This planning has helped us maintain a very positive interaction with municipalities, city councils, the Ministry of Education, and the renovation organization. Despite the coronavirus pandemic and oppressive sanctions, we have almost 55 schools that are about to open. During the next 7 months, the number is likely to rise to 100.
I was intent on finding out if school building we are talking of is actually a godly act. And donors said because of ownership disputes they've experienced in past, disputes that could endanger schools, they are now incredibly careful to build schools only on halal lands, lands that are legally and morally permissible.
The biggest problem we face in Tehran is the scarcity of land. If the lands are available, we can seek the help of the benefactors. We have great donors. We have benefactors like Mr. Ebrahimi, who has built 180 schools, Mr. Kalamchi with 170 schools, Mr. Davarpana with 300 schools, and so forth. These figures are on a national scale and not specifically in Tehran province. Dr. Khosro Shahi, may God rest his soul, built 428 schools. And we weren't even allowed to name him. He asked us to wait until after his death to mention his name.
Our MP of the day is Ms. Qasemipur. She is MP for Kurdistan, Sanandaj.
Speaking of the scarcity of lands, I need to explain that the Ministry of Education has some lands. Either some honorable people dedicate their lands in our beloved country and give it to the ministry, or the municipalities set them off with the ministry. The lands are given to benefactors. Because the charity members have run into problems in the past, they insist that the lands must be in the name of the education ministry. Otherwise, they won't do any construction on the lands.
Education for all has also meant for the children of illegal immigrants, that is by the leader's decree of May 2015. Currently, some 110,000 illegal Afghan national students are studying in Iran. A total 88% of the refugees' children are studying in Iranian schools, and by next school year, beginning September the 23rd, that rate should increase to 90% in elementary schools. The Ministry of Education has allocated 10 trillion riyals, nearly $240 million, for refugees' education. This is while international donations constitute only 2 to 2.5% of the amount. A gap this great has left the ministry facing major problems.
We have a good position in the field of construction. In 2017, our country won the Sasakawa International Award for the Safety of Educational Spaces. Sasakawa is an international award given to only two countries every year, and it was the first time that this award was given to the Iranian ambassador in Mexico. Iran won first place in strengthening educational spaces.
Each year, students in Iran start school on September the 23rd, after the three-month summer holiday. But with the coronavirus pandemic at large this year, all educational centers in the country have been closed since late February 2020. And education has been conducted in three forms: in-person, virtual, and television-based. Haven't heard anything on support for education or school building today, but it is naturally on the general agenda of Parliament, which is why we are here to hear it from an MP.
I have concentrated on this issue since I've been a member because I am an educator myself. I've had a meeting with the esteemed head of the renovation organization. He agreed to a special condition for me after I explained the situation in the region. The government usually engages with the benefactors in building schools and pays 50% of the costs, but the head of the renovation organization agreed to a 70-30 scenario, meaning the government would be responsible for 70% and the donors 30%. That's because the students are in a very bad situation there. Based on per capita educational space and standards that exist in the country, I think there's half a meter of space for every student there.
The national budget bill for the next Iranian calendar year of March 2021 to 22 has foreseen a 21% rise for the renovation and retrofitting of schools. Over the past 4 years, the number of old classrooms in need of reconstruction and retrofitting has been reduced from 30% to 19.5%. Capital city Tehran has the highest number of old schools, but donors tend to donate in their own local hometowns or to deprived areas. There are some 107,000 schools nationwide with 530,000 classes, 160,000 of which are dilapidated and dangerous. That means 30% of the schools nationwide don't meet safety standards.
We give priority to esteemed benefactors who work hard to build schools in deprived regions. Because our main objective is educational equality and justice, students in deprived regions also have the right to use the same educational facilities and schools available elsewhere in our beloved Iran, so we need to start from there. The donors themselves want to spend their money somewhere that those who are really in need can benefit. Kurdistan province is one of those places, especially where my constituency is at. Because it's an immigrant-friendly city, there are 44,000 students there. The government doesn't have enough facilities to dedicate to the students, so we need to seek help from charity members.
If you examine the region itself, Tehran has more students compared to other cities. It's true that some rural areas lack schools altogether, but Tehran has a lower per capita space for every student. That's why Tehran needs much more schools than elsewhere.
Goes without say, with school building this high up on Iran's cultural agenda, in natural disaster, people waste no time in turning their eyes to the situation children find themselves in. And benefactors donated $48 million to rebuild flood-hit schools in 2018-19. The devastating floods hit 28 of Iran's 31 provinces, leaving some 1,500 schools damaged, 200 of which were razed to the ground. In the year from March 2018 to 2019, more than half of school classes were built by benefactors, and within a 10-year period, the number of dilapidated schools dropped from two-thirds to one-third.
One of the characteristics of the Iranian nation is our love for knowledge and culture. This isn't a simple claim. History has clearly shown that. For example, the development of educational spaces in our country dates back to at least 1,000 years ago. If we specifically consider schools and special spaces where education takes place, you can look at Rab Rashidi 800 years ago. Why is Rab Rashidi so famous? Rab Rashidi was a complex comprising four sections, and according to available data, it housed 5,000 students from around the world 800 years ago. Iranians have always been pioneers in the field of science and knowledge. Mirza Taghi Khan Amir Kabir built Darul Funun 160 years ago. That's another educational space built by a benevolent man.
More yet to come of our narration, but let's hear a word from others and taking a look at other media outlets in the meantime. And here's what other media outlets have to say. IGNA quotes the leader: education system should pursue formation of religious, just, ideal society, says Ayatollah Khamenei. The Islamic government was established on the basis of this goal: the formation of a religious, just, ideal society. Naturally, the education system of the country cannot pursue a goal in opposition to the overall goal pursued by the whole system. He said this on the occasion of National Teachers' Day. The leader outlined, children, the youth and young adults in our Islamic society learn that they should develop and utilize their talents and their potential capabilities on the path of achieving lofty national values, Islamic and revolutionary values. Islam invites us to acquire beneficial knowledge. On the one hand, beneficial knowledge equips young Iranians with the necessary tools for the progress and growth of their country and people. And on the other hand, it gives them identity and enriches them with dignity, psychological and spiritual esteem and self-confidence. We have a word from Tehran Times. If anything ever deserved high representation, school building ambassadors coming to aid education system. In line with the document of the fundamental transformation of education, people who have a popular reputation are being invited as ambassadors to attract public participation for school construction. The director of the Organization for Renovation, Development and Equipment of Schools said this. School building ambassadors have been selected in 4 provinces of the country so far, and we are going to have 1 school ambassador from each province, Irna quoted Mehrollah Rakhshani Mehra saying. It has always been thought that only a certain number of people can afford to build a school, but all people can participate, even by buying a brick, he highlighted. He further explained that a system is set up in which under-construction projects are introduced, and users can select each project and pay as much as they can to build a school. Not to forget the importance of UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund in Education, Tehran Times says, Education Ministry UNICEF Inc. MOU to enhance COOP. The Ministry of Education and United Nations Children's Fund have signed a Memorandum of Understanding to expand cooperation in 2021. Iran's Deputy Education Minister for International Affairs, Ghulam Reza Karimi, and UNICEF representative in Tehran, Mandeep O'Brien, discussed further cooperation in a meeting in Tehran. During the meeting, Karimi expressed readiness to cooperate with UNICEF to improve the quality of education in compliance with Iran's Islamic approaches. He discussed the activities of the Ministry of Education in combating the pandemic and school reopening and asked UNICEF to provide the ministry with the best global experiences in the field of education. The UNICEF representative praised Iran's efforts in education coverage, especially 99% student enrollment and the elimination of inequality in the education of girls and boys, and announced readiness to cooperate with Iran in intercultural education for refugees and to provide successful global experiences in education. That would be it for the news section. Some 2,500 public schools are operational in Tehran, and every year, 10 of them are added to a long list of dilapidated ones, while only 3 to 4 new schools are established annually. Since 2006, some 50% of the schools nationwide have been reconstructed, and the rest are waiting for budget allocation to be renovated. Tehran has been estimated to need roughly $250 million to rebuild ramshackle schools and another $110 million to make them earthquake resistant. Education means so much to Iranian society that even people with professions far from anything academic have involved themselves in school building. Mostly people with no other academic involvement, actually. Looking at the different uses some of the educational donations have been put into and what it has produced is touching. I was told by donors that the late Imam Khomeini himself gave 500 million riyals at time of war, which was divided between schools.
If you make an assessment, the culture of education and research has been growing since the Islamic Revolution. That is, for example, our students who win awards in the field of nanotechnology are mostly educated in less advantaged areas of the cities. We are now the world's 6th leading country in the field of nanotechnology. This shows that if the educational spaces are prepared for the use of our dear students, they enthusiastically use them to realize their great mission to achieve their high cultural and educational goals.
But even with 110,000 schools and 550,000 classrooms in the country, roughly speaking, challenges remain. The country has 14 million school kids with 5 square meters of school space per kid. Classrooms of 32 students on average need to be reduced to 24 students. If you plan to become a donor, you should know donors can supervise school management.
If someone wants to join the school builder charity association, they can contact the association or the renovation organization by doing a simple internet search. They provide their primary information, including how much they're willing to spend and what they want to do. They can either come to Iran themselves or choose a relative, friend, or an acquaintance to take care of the work as their representative. It's interesting to know that the latter method has become more frequently used recently. It wasn't as easy in the past. Now, the benefactors know people who are well aware of the regulation and know what to do and how to build the schools.
The Charity Schools Association of Iran is the best place to raise this money. Most donors, for example, want to write a check in our name, but we do not accept it and tell them to deposit it in the account of the assembly. Even if the donors pay money to the renovation organization, the body transfers the sums to the association. The association has a lot of money and is decisive. The association sometimes completes semi-finished school projects because people have more trust in it than the other organizations.
Going by 2018 information, while in the 1970s the enrollment rate of the boys and girls in primary education was 70%, this currently exceeds 98%. There are elementary schools in almost all areas across the country, and in some regions there are elementary schools with just one student.
We have 3 historical periods in school construction in Iran. One was Darul Funun, another period goes back to the time of Rushdie and Bakhchaban, who found the schools for deaf students. The third one is the modern era. We are now looking to construct schools that would meet all educational needs of students while being a safe and comfortable environment that can fully withstand natural disasters.
Well, Iran has long had a strong educational base to build on, and it has done so. Talking of children in schools, it's not to say there are no out-of-school children, but numbers of out-of-school kids in primary school age have dwindled. It is noteworthy enrollment of boys and girls in primary education is almost equal in Iran.
Our noble benefactors work really hard and make sacrifices. This is because they realize that a transcendent society needs an educational environment that promotes culture. We are thankful to God that now Iran is rich in culture. Members from UNESCO visited Iran at the invitation of the renovation organization. We took them for a tour of the schools built by donors. It was totally unbelievable for them. They said, how is it possible for a person to donate such astronomical amounts to build a school? When we told them that someone holds a record of building 428 schools, they couldn't believe it. Most of the members told us you should win the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do return next week and each week after, as you never know what's on. Wishing you all the best for the new year, I bid you farewell.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the 5th divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the 4th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Abu Ja'far al-Baqir, peace be upon him, talked about the virtue of reason. He denoted that it was the greatest of all things which Allah the Exalted created. He, peace be upon him, said, "When Allah created reason, he tested it. Then he ordered it to come forward, and it came forward. Then he ordered it to go back, and it went back. Then Allah said, 'I swear by my power and majesty that no creation of mine is dearer to me than you are, and I have made you perfect in those whom I love. Lo, to you are my orders and prohibitions, and for you are my rewards and retributions reserved.'" IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salam had many beautiful conversations with various peoples throughout his life. He was indeed one of the divinely appointed imams who had time to disseminate the teachings of pure Muhammadan Islam. And so during his tenure as this great and esteemed, honorable and noble teacher of the Islamic sciences, for he is known as Baqir ul-Ulum, the splitter of knowledges, the splitter of sciences, if you will. He went around and he spoke about many different things with his companions. In one of these conversations, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, talks with his companions about how to treat people according to the rules of social conduct which are found in Islam. So in this conversation between Imam al-Baqir and his companion, he talks about a specific subject, which is how to treat people kindly. It's very interesting, but Islam is a beautiful and perfect religion, and it is a peaceful religion which promotes safety and stability, peace of mind, body, and soul. And so here, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he talks about that we should treat people kindly. He says to his companion in this conversation, "Say to people the best words which you would want them to say to you. For Allah hates the one who curses and abuses and defames the believers. Allah detests the one who uses obscene language." It's very interesting, dear brothers and sisters. These seem to be very simple things that have been exchanged in this conversation between Imam al-Baqir and his companion. But in reality, these are very profound words which, if implemented in our daily lives, can change not only our lives, but our families and our society in general. And what are those words? Say the best words to people. And especially if you want to gauge this, then say those words with which other people, which you would want other people to say to you. And always remember that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the mighty, the exalted, he dislikes a person who curses and abuses verbally and defames and slanders and lies about and backbites the mu'mineen, the believers. So be very careful in this aspect. And finally, Allah detests one who uses obscene and vulgar language. Very beautiful words in this dialogue, which can save our humanity, brought to us by Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala uses that term, that all you who believe, لَا تُبْطِلُوا صَدَقَاتَكُمْ بِالْمَنِّ وَالْعَضَىٰ. Do not make your sadaqat, your charity, batil, null and void, on the basis of man wal aba. Man means giving it in such a way that the person on the receiving end feels, you know, you are putting him under obligation and favor. It is hurting his image, self-respect. Wal'ava means to hurt that person, not physically, by saying things or by doing it in a way that is hurtful. And this is the example where we see that our Imam becomes the embodiment for that value of the Quran about giving charity with total sincerity and in the way that it pleases Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Quran is the guide, an imam is the example for us. When you look at those ayats from Surah Baqarah at the end of it, look at, you know, يَقُولُ الْمُؤَرِّخُونَ, the historians talk about imam, and they say that our fifth imam had mentioned, إِنَّهُ أَحَدَ لِأَهْلِهِ, he had mentioned to his family members, إِذَا قَصَدُهُمْ سَائِلٌ, that whenever a beggar, sa'il means beggar, when a beggar comes to them, approaches them, and لا يقول له, they should not address him by saying, يَا سَائِلْ خُضْ هَذَا. Don't call him a beggar. Sa'il means beggar. Don't say, oh beggar, oh miskeen, come and take this. وَإِنَّمَا يَقُولُ لَهُ, say to him, if you don't even know the name, just say, Ya Abdullah, Ya Amatullah, or the servant of Allah, Burak Fiq, you know, may Allah give you barakah. You know, this is the way that the Imam is talking about how to give charity, in a sense that even a simple beggar does not feel humiliated in that process.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.